Okay. Welcome, everybody. This is the Agile estimation class. We're going to get started for real. That was just kind of, honestly, we were just killing time because we were here early. The conference managers got very paranoid and sent Joel and I an email last night. And they were very worried that we weren't in Amsterdam. So I emailed them back and said, I thought TechEd was in Barcelona this year. And they didn't take too kindly
to
that.
No, they didn't like that at all.
So they made us show up at the session like 30 minutes in advance as punishment. So
yeah.
All right, so I'll introduce, actually, Joel, why don't you introduce yourself first?
So my name is Joel. I work at Telerik. You can always reach me on Twitter at Joel Semenyuk.
Just not right now.
Not right now, because that doesn't work. I'm a Microsoft Regional Director, which is strange, because I don't work for Microsoft, I don't have a region, and I don't direct a damn thing. But it's a cool title. I like to think I'm Scott Goo's boss. It seems to work for me.
I'm just also, in your region, though.
Just in my region. If he comes to Canada, I'm his boss. I've been doing Agile and Agile-like things for a very, very long time. I'm a certified Scrum Master, PMP, Microsoft MVP in ALM. I also love the Queen. Just in case you were wondering, I do love the Queen.
That may come up later in our session, because the Queen, if you don't know, if you've never been to Canada, the Queen of England is on Canadian money. Which leads me to believe that Canada is not a real country. It's just a colony of England.
It's a commonwealth.
We obviously have some Brits in the room that have never let go. See, I live in Hong Kong. I'll introduce myself. I live in Hong Kong. In 1997, when we were handed over from the Brits to the commies, to the Chinese, we kicked the Queen off our money, Joel, and we didn't even put Mao on our money. We have pictures of the airport on our money and a picture of like the HSC bank on our money. But that said, I'm a Microsoft Regional Director as well, so Joel thoroughly explained that's a meaningless title because I'm the Regional Director for New York, but I live in Hong Kong. And I work at Telerik, which is based in Europe, so I'm always confused as to what time zone I'm in, right, because I'm from the States. And I live in Europe. I'm sorry, I work in Europe and I live in Asia. I am a member of the board of directors of the Scrum Alliance, and that is the organization that will certify you with the Certified Scrum Master, Certified Scrum Professional, Certified Scrum Trainer, Certified Scrum Star dot star. And I'm also a PMP as well for a millennia, probably since last millennia. I'm an MVP for SQL Azure. And I also work at Telerik. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer. I've been at Telerik for a long time now. I remember when Telerik was really small. And I don't actually hate the Queen. I just hate Joel's love for the Queen. And the funny thing about it is if you've seen me speak with Joel or seen a video of us, we really dwell on the Queen thing long and long and long. And so those of you that know me would think it's really funny that when the Queen had the Jubilee a few weeks ago, I was in London and he was in Canada, which was really funny.
Watching it on TV, I might add. I just, you know, while you're speaking about the Scrum stuff, why don't we do an informal poll? Raise your hand if you're doing Scrum in your workplace today. Excellent. Keep your hand raised if you're doing Scrum by the book. Huh.
No one. Everyone.
So you're doing Scrum but. You're doing Scrum but not doing daily stand-ups or Scrum but.
And let me tell you, we think that even though this is not a Scrum talk, we're both wearing rugby jerseys, so we both love Scrum. I'm on the board of directors of the Scrum Alliance. We think it's totally okay that you do Scrum but. We actually do a session called the Agile Buffet Table, where we teach how to pull pieces of each Agile methodology and build your own. And we won't be talking about that today, because today we'll be talking about one specific narrow focus, which is Agile estimation. And why don't we get rolling? Joel, why don't you tell them what the definition of an estimate is?
Well, just before I do that, I'm kind of interested in...
More polls?
Well, no. You might be interested in why we actually do this session. We've been doing this session for a very long time. And we always have people come to the session going, wow, I was always looking for this session to help me be a better estimator. And this has been a pain that's been ongoing in our software industry, at least, for as far back as I can remember. So we've invested a whole lot of our time to try to figure out how we can perfect this art called estimation, how we can get our head wrapped around becoming more predictable, how we can become more reliable with our commitments to our bosses, how we can deliver on time and deliver on budget, because there's so many expectations around Agile. In fact, when I first started working in the Agile space, I'd go into an organization, I'd say, hey, what methodology are you following? They're like, dude, we're Agile. And I'm like, oh, what does that mean? We don't do estimates. We don't do documentation. We just write code. Awesome.
And have no deadlines.
Right? And so that's put a bit of a negative flavor around what Agile is and what we can do with it. But more importantly, it's put a bit of a persona around Agile that you can't be predictable when you're doing Agile. It just takes as long as it takes. Deal with it. And we're here to say, actually, there's a whole lot of discipline that goes into true agility. And there are ways that you can become very, very precise in your estimation techniques. And that's what we're here to talk about today. So maybe you can cover the definition of estimation.
So on that note where, you know, Agile has this reputation of not being able to be precise, I think people also have short-term memories because the software industry historically, since the beginning of the industry in the 1950s, has never had the ability to be precise. We always are over budget and over time. And there's a reason for that. And you know, I lifted this off Wikipedia, and I've been using this definition for many years. All right, so it says the definition of an estimate is a calculated approximation of a result, like a deadline, a budget, which is usable even if the input data is incomplete or uncertain. So by its very definition, an estimate is flexible. It's inaccurate. It's the best attempt that we have that's usable. However, the problem that we face is something like this. Anyone ever walk down the corridors of their office and someone come up to them and say, Joel, I have an idea for a website, and it needs to be blue, and it needs to sell Scrum t-shirts. How much is it going to cost, and how long is it going to take?
4 weeks.
I would never say that. But has anyone ever been in a situation like that where you've just gotten the idea of a project and had to come up with an estimate on the fly? Okay.
And how many of you have to commit to that initial estimate? You've told me 4 weeks.
Almost everybody.
Yeah.
Right. That's the problem with estimation today in software development. And here's one of the reasons why it's a big problem.
This is a picture of my bathroom. How big is my house?
Whoa. Before you go that, I want to point out a few things. I live in, I don't know it in meters. I live in 700 square feet, and that is a luxurious castle in Hong Kong. My bathroom is very, very small, and I have one sink. Anyone here about to get married? Okay, here's some... Think twice. I'm divorced, but now remarried, and I figured out the secret after the first try. I'm very agile, right? I'm my second iteration of the marriage project. I'm on sprint two. And sprint two is done much better because I realized that you need two sinks in a marriage.
Yes.
I don't know what my wife's brother did to her as a small child, but he messed her up big time because the minute I go to brush my teeth, she runs in. And she's like, no, I need to brush my teeth. And Joel has two sinks, and I envy that.
That means I'm a better planner.
It does. So let's pull up Excel, and
so I want you to just call out some numbers. How big is my house? 2,000 square feet. Write that down, Steve.
Done.
Okay, who else? 20,000 square feet. Whoa. I don't live in Texas, sir.
He lives in Canada.
Sorry? 200 square feet.
That's a big ass
range.
That's two orders of magnitude. Don't
Anybody
you hate
else?
When non-technical people use the term order of magnitude to mean a lot? I'm like, it means 10x. And my wife goes, stop being so literal. Maybe on wife three, on sprint three of marriage might be a different story.
Anybody else with one or two more estimates? 100 square meters.
What's that in feet?
Times 9. Really? That's how easy it is?
Is it really that easy?
Because that seems way too easy, roughly.
So 900 square feet.
900 square feet.
All right.
That's good.
So Joel, tell them what they're doing wrong.
Well, let me ask you a question. Why didn't you ask me more questions about my house? Why were you so easily, I asked you, hey, give me a number for, and you started hollering out numbers. Why didn't you say, Joel, I need to know more information? That's kind of interesting. We have this, even when we're asked to present this information, we just give it. And it's a wild ass guess. That's typically how we do it. So, ask me some questions that might help you figure out how big my house is. That's an excellent question.
Okay, not that question.
Not that question. How many rooms?
Oh, I was going to give them hints, but they're obviously very smart.
I've got 5 bedrooms.
5 bedrooms? How come when I come visit you in Winnipeg, you make me stay at a hotel?
I actually make them stay in the igloo beside in the backyard. Any other questions? How many floors? I've got 2 floors and a finished underground basement. It does not include the garden. I'm not going to divulge that.
His wife is a real estate agent.
Yeah, my wife is a real estate agent for that very reason. What are the dimensions of my house?
That's cheating.
It's kind of an odd shape. Anyone else? How many other bathrooms do I have, perhaps? We've got 4 bathrooms altogether.
4 bathrooms? You have 4 people in your family.
Yep.
You can all pee at the same time.
Yep. Sorry?
Oh, hold on. They want to guess again. I mean, estimate again. I heard 5,000 square feet.
Now, let me ask him another question. We tried to define an estimate as, well, go back to the estimate slide again. What was it?
An imprecise calculation.
imprecise calculation.
Right? Calculate approximation based on input data that is incorrect.
Now, there's this concept called probability. Have you ever heard about that before? It's kind of how certain you are about something. Why wouldn't you give me a range of numbers? Why wouldn't you say, Joel, your house has got to be from 100 to 50,000 square feet? Guess what? Your estimate would have been 100% correct. Right?
So it's Joel, estimate how many people are in this room.
I estimate there are anywhere from 15 to 600. And I would be correct. I would have a 100% accurate estimate. Do you kind of see where I'm getting at here? Right, we have to think about a little bit about the probability involved based on what we know. Now, interestingly enough, the more questions you ask me, what would have happened to that range? It goes shorter and shorter and shorter, right? Initially, it went from, what was it,
20,000. We had 200 square feet. Yeah. Actually, I think your bathroom might be 200 square feet.
It could be, actually. And now you've asked me a bunch of questions.
Hold on, we look at the high and the low. Yeah, 200 square feet. So our range was literally 2 orders of magnitude, from 200 square feet to 20,000 square feet. This range goes from 900 square feet to 5,000 square feet.
Right. But the more questions that you asked, the narrower that range became. So we're presented with evidence, and you had, based on that evidence, we're able to narrow down your range of numbers that you felt comfortable doing. So anyway, I want to point out a few things that naturally, if we seem compelled to give out answers that are wrong in a particular direction, we may not have enough information to base those estimates on. And if we don't, we have to understand that the probability of us being correct is very, very low. Right?
So I'm just taking an average. It's the 20,000 and the 200, throw it off. But the average is 5,600. So Joel, do you want to tell them how many square feet your house is?
It's about 4,000.
So that means in the first iteration when the audience was just had a small amount of data, just a photo of the bathroom, the range went from 200 to 20,000, and no one was even close. Like not even the 2,000, which would be the median, was even anywhere close. It was off by over 150%. The second estimation, 900, which is more reasonable, was between 900 and 5,000. And you said it's 4,000 square feet.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's like 5 of my houses in Hong Kong.
Yeah,
or 6.
I know.
Okay. So let's actually take a look at something called the cone of uncertainty. And if you've seen us speak before, you'll know that we stress the cone of uncertainty pretty strongly. What the cone of uncertainty says is, let me actually take a quick step back, is the cone of uncertainty is statistical data compiled from the beginning of our industry until now. So it goes back to the waterfall era in the 1950s and 1960s, and sometime in the 1980s, a guy calculated the cone of uncertainty. And here's what it says. It says that at the beginning of the project, your estimate can be off by a factor of 4. Meaning is you could be off by +4 or -4. So if you guess that the square footage of the house was, what I guess, 1,000 square feet, or that it was a 4,000 square foot house, off by a factor of 4 in one direction would be about 200, and off by a factor of 4 in the other direction would be about 24,000. And you can see that we were pretty close to those numbers. Or if you estimated that a project would be 1 year, off by a factor of 4 means the project could really take between 4 years or, if you're lucky, 3 months. Right? It is a plus or a minus. Unfortunately, it's usually on the plus side.
Yeah. How many people come under their estimates consistently? Yeah, me too.
One guy. Two guys.
Yeah. Every single
There's time. Jobs for you at Teller. So what the cone of uncertainty says, the researchers have plotted the data over the course of many, many, many projects. And what they found is the following pattern, is that as the project progresses down its path, the accuracy of your predictions, of your estimates, becomes much better. So already in maybe the second phase, you're off by a factor of 2, which would mean your 1 year estimate could be 2 years or 6 months. And as you go down the phases of a project, what will happen is your estimates get better and better. When are your estimates perfect?
When
you
done.
Finish.
Exactly.
Let me ask you this question. I'm obliged to by the rules of the Agile Estimation Society, which Joel and I are the founding and only members.
AES.com.
Is that taken somewhere?
Yeah, it might be.
How many people woke up in the morning and said, today we are launching the website? You kiss your loved one goodbye and you say, meet me at the bar at 5 p.m. because we are launching the website today.
I mean, we've been working on it for 3 months. We should have a pretty good idea of whether or not we can launch it.
Plus or minus a factor of 2. Right. So you're at the far end of the cone, right? Software complete. But remember, it's still an estimate. You woke up in the morning and you said, we're going to launch by lunch. And we're going to go out and get, I was going to say, shit-faced, drinking lots of beer after lunch. So what happens is at noon comes and goes, oh, crap, the website's not up. 5 o'clock comes and goes. 6:30, phone rings. Ring, ring, ring. It's your loved one. I'm at the bar. Where are you? Oh, we're going to make it. We're going to make it. And then now it's pushing midnight, and you're about to blow your estimate of today. But you say, we have customers in the States. So it's still today if we ship it today before 4 a.m. And then 4 a.m., 5 a.m., you're like, West Coast of the States. And then, you know, 6 a.m., you've been at the office now 24 hours. And you go, it's still 11:30 p.m. yesterday in Hawaii. We totally could get this done. How many people have been in a situation similar to that?
Yeah.
Okay, almost the whole room. I'd say 85% of the room. So even when the software is about to be complete, almost everyone in the room has experienced that exact same problem, that the estimate is still not accurate. So all the cone of uncertainty says is that our estimates have a greater degree of accuracy as the project progresses forward.
As we have more knowledge.
So we've been dwelling a little bit in the past, unfortunately. We've been talking about, well, we talked about Joel's house, but we were talking about,
Queen.
What?
The Queen.
The Queen. She's not the past. She's still the Queen.
Yeah, sure enough.
But as we were talking a little bit about the waterfall methodology, the cone of uncertainty works exactly the same in software projects today, meaning these statistics have been for the last 50, 60 plus years. So this works just fine in agile methodology. You just replace those waterfall ones with sprints. I actually have the exact same slide that does the exact same thing. It just shows them with the sprints. So what we like to say is the concept of agile estimation is taking the cone of uncertainty, taking our experiences of the past, and not trying to fight them, but embrace them. Do you know what I mean by that? How many people, when you start a project, think this time is different?
This time we'll get it right.
This time we're going to make the estimate. Okay.
You're continuous optimists. Good for you.
How many of the managers in the room pretend the cone of uncertainty does not exist, but knows for damn sure it does? That's a lot of managers. That was like 10 or 8. The rest just don't want to admit it in front of the employees sitting next to them. I understand.
Yeah.
Being a manager myself. So the problem is every manager knows the cone of uncertainty exists. They may not know it by its scientific name, the cone of uncertainty, but they've all experienced it. Every developer has experienced it. Every IT pro has experienced it. So we've spent the last, you know, our entire careers fighting the cone of uncertainty. What agile estimation does is embraces it and uses it to its advantage. So what agile estimation says is re-estimate the project at the end of every sprint, knowing that your estimates will get better. Now, we're not here to talk specifically about Scrum, but Joel and I will recommend for Scrum practitioners to use shorter duration sprints, like two-week sprints. You'll notice with the cone of uncertainty that pretty quickly your estimates become pretty usable and fairly accurate, right? If you look four or five sprints down the line, you're off by a factor of less than one, and your sprints are far more usable, which means if you're using two-week sprints, after four sprints, 2 months, you actually have pretty good estimate of where things are going.
Now, Steve, I'm a touchy-feely kind of guy.
No, that's for sure.
I kind of, you know, one aspect of Agile that it promotes is that software development is not a technical problem, it's a human one, isn't it? And there's many mechanics inside of Agile and the Agile methodologies that embrace the human condition, that it wants us to communicate and the way that we communicate. How many people are on our team represent psychological barriers that we have communicating with other people. So Agile brings in a human element when it comes to estimation, when it comes to software development. Now, estimation also has many, many human elements cooked in it as well. I've run many, many projects and had many, many people on my team, and funny things start to happen. Has anybody heard of Parkinson's Law? Right? Parkinson's Law, in general, says that if given 2 weeks to do something, you'll likely take 2 weeks. Right? So air, you know, in that sense, air fills the container. Whatever size of the container. So if I were to give you the same task and I give you 3 weeks, it would likely take you 3 weeks, right? So that's an interesting human condition. Another human condition is something called the student syndrome. I suffered from this massively while going to university. Student syndrome is very, very simple. You start your class your first day, you're told that you're going to do a project or you have a project done in 3 months. When do you start the project?
The night before.
At the last possible moment is usually what happens. Now, typically, many, many people suffer from the student syndrome as well, meaning that scheduling becomes hard and it's unpredictable, and we have a lot of these human elements that are cooked into it as well. And then there's other factors like, you know, ego. I had one guy on my team years ago who would always tell me what I wanted to hear, right, but could never deliver against it. Or would always tell, like, he wanted me to think he was this great, amazing programmer, so we'd give really low estimates. So me, as an immature manager, what would I do? Triple, quadruple his estimates and put it into my plan. But because of air filling the container, and it was always hitting my expectations or exceeding them. So every time we try to get more and more fine-tuned with these small levels of measurement, we actually introduce more and more error into our estimates as well.
And Agile, just to review, is Agile estimation understands the human element as well as the scientific element. And you'll notice that some people ask, why do you have two of you guys doing this particular talk? And what's interesting is Joel will always focus on the team dynamics and the human side of things, and I focus on the mechanics and the statistics and the, you know, how do you actually perform it type of a thing. So we always will bounce those off each other. And what Agile estimation does is it acknowledges the fact that we are human and we have difficulty estimating in time, saying this is going to take 4 hours. Right, because of many things like air filling the container, Parkinson's law, student syndrome. It also knows that schedules are a little difficult. I had a problem once where we did waterfall. This is back in, why are they clapping? This is everyone.
You did waterfall.
Everyone just clap louder than them for 10 seconds. Ready? 1, 2, 3, go.
Thank you.
They got the message. Okay, we're the cooler room. They suck. So Agile estimation understands that we are imprecise in our measurements. As I was saying before we were rudely interrupted by the other rooms clapping, I once had this waterfall project, and we said on August 15th, you know, Patrick was going to spend 5 days working on blah, blah, blah. Well, on day three, he was, you know, had made 1% progress. And the CEO was like looking at the Microsoft project saying, how come he made 1% progress? And we said, well, he's actually not doing that task. He's writing a little helper utility that's going to take him 3 days that he then can accomplish that task in 30 seconds. So in essence, we're going to save 2 days. But when you're a day and a half, 2 days, 3 days in, they don't believe you, right? So agile estimation recognizes all of this, and it does it in a very different way. So we're now going to take a look at how you estimate a project in an agile environment. We're going to give you the steps. There are 6 steps. They're actually very easy, to be completely honest. This is almost all you need to know to go out and start experimenting with this in your own organization. Because very quickly, you're going to put what we say, you know, the rubber to the road, and very quickly, you'll be able to produce this in your environment.
Who here was in Dave Starr's session right before this? And what did he say? We were right, right? So they just take his advice. So let's start with user stories. And many people have a hard time with user stories. But let's get back to the why user stories work. So let's pretend this is a clicker. It's actually my cell phone, but this is a real clicker. And if I were to ask you, which one is the bigger clicker? Which one would you say? This is A, this is B. Which one? A, right? That's a pretty good sizing estimate. You got another one? Okay. Which one of these holds more liquid? A. Cool. All right.
What about Canadian.
What about this? Which one of these holds more liquid? C.
All of the above. Is that what C is?
They're probably close to the same. Did you know that as human beings, we're pretty good at comparing things and knowing which is larger and which is smaller and the magnitude of things, even when they're abstract? Even when we're talking about features and requirements, we're pretty good at looking at something going, yeah, that's pretty big. Or, yeah, that's not bad, right? We can compare two things really, really well. What we may not be very good at estimating might be how many millimeters of liquid would fill this to 3/4 of its container. Yeah, you'd be guessing, right? So here I am. I'm asking you to compare two things, and you don't feel like you're guessing anymore. To now I'm asking you to how many millimeters fills this. Now you're guessing. So my way of approaching this is, let's take away guessing and do what humans do best and compare two things at a certain time. Hence, user stories. Now, user stories are a way of representing requirements. Now, the way that they're written, I think you might have an example of one coming up, is it expresses a user requirement in the context of someone who's consuming value and the value that we want to produce. And so it really kind of helps us understand who we're producing this value for and how they're going to, and what they're going to achieve as a result of this production. Now, what this doesn't necessarily do at this point is talk about exactly how we're going to implement this, right? But it does allow us to focus on value because, for example, when we're estimating priority, which we'll talk about a little bit later on, we do need to actually have an understanding of the value that's behind it as well. So one of the things that we like to do with user stories is we like to assign them points. Now, you're thinking, why wouldn't I just estimate in hours? Well, estimation in hours is kind of like me asking you how many milliliters would fill this cup to 3/4 full. But when we estimate in points, what we do is we arbitrarily assign an anchor number to something. Let's call this 3. For no apparent reason, we're just going to call this 3. Now, if I were to ask you what number this would be, what could you tell me? 6 seems pretty reasonable, right? And that's kind of what we do with user stories. We will arbitrarily choose a story that we're pretty confident about. You know, we've done something over and over again. Hey, that's something we're pretty certain about, and assign it a number. And then we do binary comparisons between those two. Is this thing larger or is this thing smaller than this thing that we're pretty sure about? And if so, what is the magnitude of size difference? Or if there's too much uncertainty, we can kind of flag it at that time. We couldn't estimate it because we don't know enough.
And this is the fundamental mechanics of agile estimation. Remember, Joel explains a lot of the human side of things. I get to the technical side. And the mechanics of agile estimation, if we just look at our list, is we create user stories and then compare those user stories to a baseline user story. Okay, we still have to go back and define what a user story is, but that is the fundamental mechanics of agile estimation. We break our work down into user stories, then we compare the user stories and give them a point. The points do not mean hours. And then we go in and start doing the estimation. Before we dive into a lot of that, the other thing I'd like to mention is where user stories are comparing against a baseline, saying user story was when Joel was holding them up, a 3 and a 6. It's moving away from saying this is going to take 8 hours, this is going to take 4 hours. It's saying we're going on a relative scale that is not based on time. And that's very important. We eventually equate that and plot that and make it equal to time, but never saying that 6 story points is worth 4 hours or something like that. And we're introducing terminology that not all of you are familiar with, so we'll actually go in and define it now.
Now, one of the other reasons that we like user stories,
or maybe not,
is because it's a design pattern, right? It's a way that if you get 4 people writing user stories and they're all using the same design pattern, we're at least kind of doing, you know, specifying what we want to build in kind of the same language. And that's really important when we're doing estimation. If I'm describing this cup and this one, I want to have a similar way of describing them so that, in fact, I can compare them. So that's another reason why we want to have user stories. And if you've got, you know, if you've looked online for any stuff about BDD, behavioral driven development, which Dave Starr actually does a lot of work within, user stories are really important for getting into test-driven development and helping generate automated tests based on your specifications. So there's a lot of cool stuff that you can get into once you actually have a design pattern for your requirements. In fact, when I was a full-time Agile consultant, one of the first things I would go in an organization is we need to speak the same language, and we would actually define that design pattern for the definition of our software so we can actually get it all in the same place and estimate properly.
So the design pattern is very simple. It works like this. You say, as a role, I would like to perform a function or do an action in order to obtain some goal. So a user story can be something as simple as this. As an administrative user, I would like to be able to search for customers by first and last name in order to facilitate faster customer service when the customer is on the phone with me. Right? That is a perfect example of a user story. It's the right size. It's basically one long sentence. And it will describe one key feature of your application. The developers may break the user story down into tasks later on, but that's not important for both estimation and for planning. Another feature of a user story is true, you know, in the olden days, you know, 10, 12 years ago, the agile teams shunned tools. And they would like to write user stories. What are you doing? Shift, Control, H. What does
That's
that do?
That's not my notes. Those are Dave's
notes. I would like
notes.
To know what Shift, Control, well, we'll do that later. So they would write user stories on an index card. And they would actually write out the user story using that template. On the back of the user story, they would put the acceptance criteria, meaning the business would put in a fairly free-form but structured manner, this is what we're going to use to evaluate that this user story is complete. So what's interesting about a user story, it becomes a task not only for the development team, but the testers already can start writing their test cases. They're going to make sure that those user stories will correspond with what the developers actually deliver. In addition, there's another little hidden feature of the user story that we don't talk about that much, which is the value. The value that it's adding should map back to some of the goals of the system. Right, meaning the value is to provide fast customer service, or at least it makes the business and the technical people, when they're writing the user stories, think through why we're building this feature. Too many times people build a feature because they think it's needed, not because of the value that it's going to give to the system. So now that we have user stories, the other thing that we like to talk about with user stories is that's mechanical is that we like the business owner or the product owner to write the user story. Sometimes they'll need help from the development and technical team. Most of the times they won't because they're the experts in the product. And then we also like the user stories not to go on and on for a really long period of time, right? We call those epic user stories. If you see a user story that goes on for more than a short paragraph, you're doing it probably inefficiently and should rethink the user story more for the design pattern that you see above. Right? So, you know, as a customer service representative or as an administrative user, as a role in your application. When you get started with user stories, you can define the roles so that people aren't just making up roles. And if you're starting to argue over things as fundamental as the roles, you shouldn't be writing the user stories until you have those down. Okay. Want to talk about story points since you
already talked about story points, really.
That's true.
But again, just to reinforce that humans are really good at comparing things, even if they're abstract. Steve, you're getting nervous, apparently.
No, I actually wrote this. No, you keep talking.
Oh, so now this is sometimes a giant leap for many organizations because you are pressured to give estimates in time. Why? Because your estimates in time can be converted to dollars very quickly, and that's what people are really concerned about. They're really concerned about what? How long it's going to take for me to get that and how much it's going to cost, right? That's what they're really asking when they're asking for an estimate. So what we're doing over here, interesting, is...
You said you made the same mistake both times we did this session.
What mistake is that?
You know, your comparison, your apples, your oranges, your water bottles, you're supposed to do it on this slide.
There is no mistake, it was a natural flow. Now you threw me off. I don't have flow. I am not in Kanban mode. What was I talking about?
You were talking about how great I was at writing this slide down and how story points are a relative approximation against the baseline. So Joel very likes to, you know, hold up the coffee cup and the soda bottle and say, which is bigger? So what story points do is formalize that. So the way you get this accomplished in your environment is you get a bunch of user stories together. So you get maybe 20 or 30 user stories and you go through them. I would suggest writing 3 or 4 user stories with the business and then reviewing them if you've never done agile estimation and user stories before. The good news is if you're performing other agile methodologies, you may have some experience with user stories already. Just quick show of hands. How many folks have some experience with user stories already? Awesome. Almost everybody. So that's perfect. So what we then say is take a user story that you know, like definitively, that you could do in a certain period of time. Who cares what the period of time is? Or you know definitively how complex it is. I always use the example of maybe adding a customer record or adding a login screen. Like, we know how long it takes to build a login screen. So you take those user stories and you pick one and you make it your reference user story or your baseline user story. And you assign it a numerical number. You can assign it a 1. Joel likes to assign it 3. And then you go to every other user story and you say, how much more complex is this user story compared to our baseline? So going back to the coffee cup and the soda bottle, if this is our baseline as a 3, what would this be?
I already went through this.
I know. But this is how you perform agile estimation, right? You are comparing your user stories to each other. But we have a problem. The problem is, how many bosses are in the room again? Okay, so, and how many people are sitting next to their boss?
Are your bosses asking you how many story points features are?
I'm going to say it more like this. How many people would like to work on a team with me? Not many. They're smart. They've heard this before. Okay, you guys really don't want to work on a team with me. Let me ask the question a different way. They teach you in speaker school. If you don't get the answer you want, you ask the question a different way. How many people think that I could be argumentative, talk too much, and combative in meetings? Oh, I can't believe they get that just by the last half hour.
I wonder how that works.
So this is how an estimation of story. So we went through agile estimation, you know, user stories, story points. So what's a good way to estimate story points? So this is a problem that you would face in a meeting with me. Joel would try to be a facilitator, the polite Canadian. We're now going to estimate user story, blah, 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 right? You know, as a customer service representative, admin user, I would like to search by customer by first and last name in order to, you know, be on the phone with the person. And you are thinking in your head, this is going to take, you know, a long time. Against the baseline, I'm going to give this a 20, right? Before you open your mouth, I just go, only an idiot would do this in, like, you know, this is lower than the baseline, right? You know, you think it's this, you know, this is the baseline, and, like, I'm saying it's tiny, and I'm banging my thing down saying, this is the easiest feature we can build.
And he's your boss.
And I'm your boss. This happens at Telerik all the time. That's why we're late on everything. How many people would change their 20? Be honest. Be honest. Yeah. Okay. Well, not many. I like the Europeans. When we asked this in Orlando, like everyone rose their hand.
Yeah.
So either the Americans are weak.
They are.
Or the Europeans are just more.
You don't have the queen.
Screw you. Like, we have monarchs in Europe. We're
That's right.
They have corporate security. Yeah,
job security.
Job yeah. security. Right. Except the ones in Greece, Spain, and Italy, I guess, yeah. right? Okay, so I was at an event in London last week or the week before, whenever the Jubilee was, and the moderator was the editor of Wired. He goes, the hashtag for this event is, you know, Bismarck EU. He goes, but we're going to change it to Bismarck EU, you know, and then put a dash, Greece, Italy, and all of those. So how do we solve this problem, right? How do we solve the problem of the loudmouth, argumentative boss that will affect your decision, right? A lot of people in the room said, oh, I'm gonna change my decision, I'm gonna be uncomfortable. And, oops, the way we do that is with a concept called planning poker, which Joel's gonna explain to you.
Well, this is the human touchy-feely stuff again, isn't it?
He loves the human touchy-feely stuff.
One of the things that we like to do with planning poker, let me speak to the mechanics of it first, and then I'll tell you why it's
important. Mechanics guy.
You're no. a mechanics, I'm just, well, you stepped on my shows, I'm sticking on yours. The mechanics of it is we'll discuss the user story as a group. You know, here's the user story. Let's have a discussion around it. Everyone gets a deck of cards which has those numbers in it which represent their estimate. Now, you can make this simpler if you want. Some teams use, you know, 1, 3, 5, infinity. Some people actually have various numbers. But the purpose for this is that we all show our numbers at the same time to prevent loudmouths from influencing what our thoughts are.
Big, loud, stupid Americans.
Big, loud, stupid Americans. All applaud, yes. Now, the reality is that what we're looking for is consensus. What would happen if Steve put up a 1 and I put up a 20? He's actually, 21. Now, here's the touchy-feely part.
I'll still call you an idiot.
You'll still call me an
idiot. But you've already voted.
But there's obviously something that we're not aligned on. And guess what? The thing that you want the most out of your team is alignment. We all have to be thinking about the same thing. If I'm thinking we're building the Taj Mahal and you're thinking you're building an igloo, we're going to have dramatically different results when it comes to building the software. So what do we do after we find this discrepancy? Anyone? We talk.
We talk.
Crazy stuff.
Just like when you guys started asking about Joel's house, right? So planning poker is a facilitation device to get us talking amongst developers, testers, the business owners. Everyone participates in the planning poker session.
And we have discussions. And we'll bring in more information with the product owner to help clarify things. We might maybe even decompose the story if we find it's like, wow, that is really big. It's too big. We're going to break it down into some sub-stories that we can, in fact, estimate. Or estimate pieces of those stories and not others. So we have that discussion. And that's why we like to use planning poker as a mechanism for, first of all, not having the human factor of, you know, someone else estimating for you. And second of all, to allow us to understand when conversation is required. And the conversation is really what blends knowledge across the team, so we all have a common perspective of what we're building and why we're building it as well.
So another aspect, the reason why the mug of beer is up there is because we would say, if this is a 3, what's the beer? Right? Because we were using the Coke bottle many times. And what's interesting about this is the first time you are working on a story that's not as straightforward, where I have a 1, he has a 20, then you discuss. If you vote on it a second time and you're further apart or equally as far apart, our recommendation is you actually put that story aside and work on a brand new story. And it's not really procrastination or sweeping the problem under the rug. It's let's work on 1 or 2 more and see if we have the same problem. If the next 2 or 3 stories were off by, you know, 1 and 20, whoa, we really need to kind of reevaluate what we're doing in general. If you're very close on the subsequent stories, then you can go back to that story that you were really way off on, and you've built a little bit more trust, you've built a little bit more camaraderie with the team, and you understand, you know, the testers have to test harder on this or that, and you could actually start working the conversation a second or a third or even a fourth time.
And sometimes I have to interject and remind people what the baseline is. Because sometimes, remember that we're arbitrarily choosing a baseline and arbitrarily giving it a number. And if you have people from different teams from, you know, that have chosen a baseline in other projects, for example, that's different of this, they might be thinking different numbers. So what you still have to do on, as an ongoing, is remind people what the baseline is and have people compare that new estimate to that baseline that everybody does agree upon.
And what's important with the baseline is another recommendation we have on the mechanics. If you have a brand new team together that has never worked together and it's using a new technology, you're using HTML5 or using something you've never used before, you may want the team to actually do what we call a spike and spend a day and build the baseline to get to know each other better and to know the baseline better. Usually, if you're lucky, you'll have developers that have worked together and have done something similar to that baseline in the past. But if you're working on a brand new project with a brand new team with brand new technology, you might want to work on that baseline before you start with the planning poker session and assigning the story points to each particular user story. All righty. Let's go back to our... Where's our slide here? Our how to estimate slide. You can see we kind of make the slides up as we go along. So the next item is the product backlog. And we have a question. You're going to have to speak loud because I have the other guy's session blasting in my ears. Repeat the question, Joel.
The question is, why are we estimating user stories and not the tasks required to create the stories? Generally speaking, we might not know enough, to be honest with you. Some teams actually start thinking in their mind what it would actually take to do that. And in fact, they might do a certain level of decomposition to kind of validate some of their story point assessments. Some points will just kind of look at things knowing that this was the baseline, and generally speaking, they want to do the basic comparison. But also remember that as you do decomposition, each estimate that you do at the task level, if there's more than 7 and you're trying to do roll-ups, introduces a fair amount of error in the actual estimate. Roll-up estimation is a very dangerous thing that can get yourself into trouble because 9 times out of 10 when I've been developing software, I'll start doing it and forgot about 4 tasks, right? So things change or the sequencing might change. So it depends on the team. For example, my team at Telerik, we don't get into task decomposition, but what we've done is when our baseline, we have done a lot of decomposition on. We generally know how much effort it's going to take to design, to build, to test, to put it into deployment, whether or not we have to update the installer. And generally speaking, we use that. That's good enough for us to do the user stories. For teams that are still working together, decomposition is not wrong. It will get you kind of talking the same language. That might be what we might discuss if our estimates are way wrong. It's like, oh, Steve, you forgot that we have to change the build process in the same time, right? That's a task. And then go, oh, yeah, you're right, changing the estimates. So.
And I brought up the cone of uncertainty just to punctuate what Joel said on this question, because the amount of effort you put in to also estimate at the first decompose a user story into tasks and then estimate those tasks does not give you any more accuracy. Actually, the data shows it gives you more inaccuracy. We're going back to waterfall, to big Microsoft Project spreadsheets that say, you know, Bob is working on this task on this day at this hour. So the team itself, the development team, can start decomposing that tasks before they work on it and maybe start doing rough estimates. But for the concept of agile estimation, which is re-estimate the entire project after every sprint, doing it at the story level is just fine. Which you'll start to see as well as we progress down the chain.
And to follow up on that, when you want to promote re-estimation, you don't want to make it dreadfully painful if you have to do re-decomposition for 50 stories, for example.
Okay, so one more question, and then we'll go into the product backlog. Shout it as loud as you can.
So we had this question last time. The question was, what part of the user story do you estimate? Is it when it's done, into production perhaps? They might have had to gone through UAT testing or integration testing or something like that. Or is it just from your perspective of a developer? And the right answer from me, and Steve, you might have a different one, is whatever you have control over, whatever you're done. I've worked in organizations that had strict transition to production stages that we had no control over, that sometimes took months. So we only estimated done as in when we gave it to that level. Some organizations estimate up to including testing. However, that's not very agile to do testing at the end. We believe that testing should be throughout and starting with the requirements themselves. You'll have to find that balance yourself. So us at Telerik, it's done. It's documentation done.
But we are an ISV and have control over the whole product.
Exactly.
Right? So just to give you the official answer that you would learn if you took an agile estimation class, the proper answer, the best practice, is everything. Meaning is the business the business aspects, even everything that gets you down the road. But Joel's answer is more real world, which is whatever you as a team have control over. If you have a disengaged product owner, which is the biggest risk in your organization to your project's health, right, a disengaged product owner. If you have a disengaged product owner, then you really only have control over the technical features, right? And that's what will define what done is.
And here's an example from us. I mean, when we'll make a functional change, if it impacts the GUI quite a bit, we go, oh, wow, we'll have to update like 30 pages of documentation and 14 videos and all these other things. They come into play when we think about the estimates for
help
for
files, right? All that stuff. Yeah. So just to review where we've come so far, right, with agile estimation, we talked obviously what agile estimation was with the cone of uncertainty. Agile estimation is based on the past, which will help you sell it in the future to your boss, except for the bosses that are here, because they're going to walk away like, done, we're doing agile estimation. So we talked about user stories, the design pattern of defining your requirements. We had a question about, should we decompose those into tasks? Then we talked about story points and the relative comparison of the user stories. And we talked about a facility or a mechanism of doing story point estimation called planning poker. And I think we had one more question before we dive into the product backlog.
We're going to get right into that in the concept called velocity to help determine what story
Repeat
points.
Repeat the question.
The question
I didn't
is,
even
do we take into account now how many hours some of the employees work or their experience and stuff like that when it comes to points? And we're going to talk about a concept called velocity, which helps you tie points now to time and money and duration to help try to figure out those things and be a bit more predictive to weed out some of those issues.
Yeah, and just to kind of, since we're reviewing, we did story points, planning poker and user stories is, remember we're comparing these two. What if on my team we said this baseline is a 1, and on Joel's team they said this baseline is a 30? And then what's this? Right, on my team this is like a 3, and on Joel's team this is a 90. So the number, the actual number of a story point is irrelevant. Okay, we're going to get into velocity in a minute, okay, and what that means, so don't worry. We're introducing terms that we're going to explain just in a minute. And then back to the question, which was, do you take into account the team's experience when you're deciding? And the answer is, you're always doing that in the back of your head, right? Meaning is, if you know that the team that you work, that you're working with, is of a certain level, high, ninja team, medium team, slow team, and it's a 3, a 6 for the ninja team is different than a 6 for the slow team. Right? That's always going to be relative to the people working on the project. So there are issues if you work on a 3-year-long project and you switch team members and things like that, which we'll talk a little bit about.
And some of the other engineering practices help blend this out, where we don't promote people working in isolation, that we blend them. We always talk about pair programming. Some people do it, some people don't. But what we want to do is blend as much skills as possible, so that even if you get a junior developing on that, he'll have the support of his peers on a design and implementation basis to kind of blend those things out, and vice versa.
Okay, so let's just go over the easiest part of the class, which is the product backlog. Show of hands, how many people have worked with and know what a product backlog is? Okay, just about everyone. But just for completion, we'll show our take of a product backlog. We'll make a quick backlog. In my opinion, and Joel may not even agree 100% with this, but I think he does, you have the item, or this user story. Right, the user story. Let me make this even a little bigger for people in the back. Apparently, that is as big as
you're inside editing a cell. You can't do that.
That's a design flaw of Excel.
There's a whole session on that.
Who knows what the world's best project management software is?
Team Pulse.
It's called Microsoft Excel, ladies and gentlemen. So then you're going to have the points. And then, in my opinion, and this is where I differ from some of the Scrum and the Agile prescription, I like to put priority. Not everyone says you need priority there. So, you know, the user story might be A, B, C, and blah, 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 blah. And then you have the points. This one might be 18 points. This might be 20
You got two of the same story in there.
And 14 points.
Just
it's so similar that it needed high, super duper high.
When you ask a user to prioritize a list of features they want, what do you get? They're all high. They're all must-haves. Right?
So what we do is we say you're allowed to have 3 highs, right, and 10 mediums and 4 lows or something like that, right? We actually limit the number of highs and then say as the project progresses, you can promote things to highs. But the backlog can only have a certain fixed number of high-priority work items or user stories at any given time. It's a very effective feature. So we'll just say this would be high.
I don't personally subscribe to that. I just like it to be ordered in terms of priority. As long as the top ones, the most important are at the top and the least important are at the bottom. But this is where estimation becomes really, really critical. I need a volunteer. You. You're really thirsty. Tell me you're really thirsty. I've got a bottle for you. But it's going to cost you money. How much is your next question? It's going to cost you 1 million euros. Are you still thirsty? You're not thirsty. So estimation and prioritization go hand in hand, don't they? Right? It's hard to prioritize value without understanding what it costs for me to get that value. So prioritization always, always goes hand in hand with estimation, and that's why we like to kind of do estimation first as a group and then let our business users understand what value is by just prioritizing that from high to low.
And that's why one of the tenets of agile estimation is that we reprioritize the backlog after every sprint. So let's go back to our slide real briefly just so we know where we're at. But as I said, we talked about user stories, assigning points to those stories, usually using something like planning poker. Now you're just putting all your user stories with the associated story points into a bucket, into a list, into the world's most common project management software. I predict that the Microsoft Surface will sell millions and millions of copies if they have Excel on it, right? And the iPad doesn't. That's my prediction. I could be wrong. But so we've now created the concept of a product backlog. So now it's the first sprint. It's time for us developers to get to work. These guys are pissing me off. Can we have one more super loud chant and do some woo-woos or something as well? Ready? 1, 2, 3. Woo! Woo! All right. Developers, developers, developers. Okay, so now it's the first sprint. Developers will now take items out of the product backlog and put it into the sprint backlog. What usually happens in that first sprint? Do developers overcommit or undercommit? Overcommit.
Overcommit.
That's okay.
That's fine.
That's perfectly acceptable, especially if you know it exists. If you don't know it exists, it really doesn't matter. Because at the end of the very first sprint, if the developers have completed 22 story points.
Doesn't matter how many stories, but how many
story points. Doesn't matter
how
many stories, but they've completed a certain amount of story points. That becomes a very important number called team velocity. Team velocity is the cumulative average of the team's completion of the number of story points. Right, so if the team completes 20 story points on average over the course of the project, that is the team velocity. I'll show a slide, and I know Joel will like to add something to team velocity. So, putting it in. Joel, that was your
now,
cue.
Oh, that was my cue. Team velocity is kind of this funny thing, especially if you've got a new team with working that's working together on some new technologies. Sometimes you just don't know how much work you can complete. So here's an example. Our first implementation of Team Pulse was based on Silverlight. Now we're getting into HTML5, thinking, well, we should be, you know, we've been working as a team. We know how each other works. We know our processes. It works really well. But all of our HTML5 estimates are way wrong.
Super wrong.
Super wrong. Because we didn't know as much about it as we did Silverlight.
And so, what happens to your cumulative team velocity when you introduce the new technical...
It goes down, right? But the thing is...
Does everyone here feel comfortable screaming "you suck" three times at them? I'm just saying. Okay.
So, but what's happening is that iteration by iteration, we are measuring how much we can complete in story points, and it's a result of our learning. And actually, our story points, our velocity is going up as a result of that, meaning that as we get more proficient, as we learn the technology, our velocity is increasing. But it also allows us to be much more predictable in terms of what we can deliver in our release. Now, this is very important when it comes to things like time and money. If I have to go 600 kilometers and I'm only going 20 kilometers an hour, oh, those are hard numbers. If I'm going 100 kilometers an hour, how long should it take for me to get there? 6 hours? But I've only got 5 hours to get there.
What if I have to stop and pee?
Right? These are issues that we all deal with. So we have to understand sooner than later whether or not, you know, we're going to be in trouble missing our deadlines. So one of the things that we can do with velocity is we can try to predict whether or not our velocity is going to get there on time. And if it's not, what do we have that conversation? We have to talk about things we're not doing, shortcuts that we have to take in order to get there. And that's why that prioritized backlog is really important, because we want to figure out, we want to deliver the highest value stuff, and if we can't get it all done within that fixed amount of time, then at least we're always giving them the highest value, and the things at the bottom of the list might not get done.
Okay, so, like, are they giving away free cars, like on Oprah?
Maybe it is Oprah.
If we had the internet and showed I want to be an engineer, like, these guys would be pounding their seats on the floor. Okay, so they must be talking about the Surface tablet. That's got to be it. Oh, no, they gave away iPads to everyone in that room. Oh, wait, no, this is a Microsoft conference. So we are now at where the most important kind of conclusion, so to speak. It's all coming together. If you've wondered why we talked about all these things, let's actually see how the math works out, so to speak. Okay? So we talked about the user stories. We've estimated them as story points. You know, we used Plenty Poker to get there. We put it into the product backlog. The developers overcommitted and underdelivered in the first sprint. The second sprint, they probably undercommitted and overdelivered. And by the third and fourth sprint, team velocity kind of smoothed out, unless they hit some of the roadblocks and some of the challenges Joel mentioned. Now the first sprint, the second sprint is over. How do we really reestimate? Right? Like, how do we put this all together? Well, it's actually quite simple. And we have a spreadsheet. So ignore these for a minute. I'm going to make
these. You can hide them.
I know I can hide them, but I don't know how to unhide them easily.
You can click on unhide.
I know, but that's requiring a lot more intelligence I have. Okay, so we have a real simple spreadsheet that you can use. I'll just bump this up. Can everyone see that in the back? More or less? Okay, it's like size 1 million font, so it's good. So this is story points, not stories. You could do it your own way. This is just something Joel and I have been working on, and we find that it works well. So we just want to say, now that you have done your estimation, and this is important, as long as your user story estimates are consistently inaccurate, get what I mean by that? As long as you have used the same process to devise these stories, you're going to be one story that was a 5 was really a 4, but one that was a 3 is really a 2. So they usually will even out. So as long as you were consistently applying your estimates when you did your planning poker, and you use the same baseline, you can use a technique like this to start to re-estimate the duration of the project at the end of every sprint. So here's how it works. Joel and I, these people are, these salt, how about we all chant later when the session is over, these pretzels are making me salty. Oh no, these pretzels are making me thirsty, you know, from Seinfeld. Okay, so Joel and I like to say is, why estimate when you can actually measure certain data points and certain metrics? So here are some of the things that we would like to capture. First is the backlog size at the beginning of the sprint. How many did the team commit to? Remember, the team overcommits and underdelivers, right? So they committed to 10 and completed 7. That's normal, and that's not a problem. What will their velocity be? Don't look. Shout it out really loud so the other room can hear you. That was
very
good. So loud.
Wow.
That was so loud that I didn't even hear him. I'm going to assume they said 7.
He said 7.
Now, here's the problem. Does that mean our backlog is 93?
No.
Of course not.
Because as a product manager, I have ideas. And as I see things come out, I have more ideas.
I call this the OBTW. Oh, by the way, Right? So we have five OBTWs added after the very first sprint. And of course, we're developers. We only added one bug. And that was actually that one developer we fired because we're perfect. And that one developer is off the team. And the good news is this is the reverse OBTW. Right? How many items were removed from the backlog? Believe it or not, this does happen, but it doesn't usually happen until after like the fifth or sixth sprint. And it's that like one item on the bottom that you knew you never were going to do anyway. Right? So this would say if you take your velocity and you divide it by the amount of work items left, and the amount of work items left is 100 minus the 7 you completed plus the 5 OBTWs plus the one bug, gives you, divided by the velocity of 7, 14.14 weeks to completion. Sprints to completion.
Sprints, yeah.
If the sprints are 2 weeks, that would say roughly 28 weeks to completion.
That's good.
Now,
good math.
Back to our wonderful cone of uncertainty. How much do we trust this estimate? We're only at the first sprint, right?
Not so much.
So not so much. Can you start, though, saying to marketing, ooh, you know, we have a trade show in 30 weeks. We're going to hit that number. You probably don't want to commit to that. But you can use the agile estimation tools to start to, if 30 weeks will then become the hard deadline, you can use the agile estimation tools to say, well, let's start removing features to see if we can get to that 30 weeks. So let's just take this a little further, and I'm going to just explode here, sprints 2, 3, 4, and 5. So let's now look at sprint number 2. And after your first sprint, we actually then start to bring in another calculation to weight your average. And I'll show you what that means in a second. So remember, our first product backlog was at 100. We completed 7, but we added 6. So our backlog is 99. This represents a good scenario that the product backlog actually went down after the first sprint. Because usually the product backlog, there's so many OBTWs, and there's also a few bugs. You know, it might be 105 or 110. But this is, you know, ninjas working on the project, and we're down to 99. The team commits to 8, completes 8. Our cumulative team velocity is 7.5. So we have 4 OBTWs, 2 bugs, nothing removed. So we can say we're at 13 sprints, or 26 weeks to completion, right? 12.93. Everyone follow me so far? Okay, great. That's almost everyone. So I'm going to assume that is the case. So now we have the concept of bugs. We also have the concept of rework. We need to allocate time in order to assess the bugs that come in order to do planning poker on the bug, to see what are the technical requirements of the bug, and add them to the backlog with the high-low. If you don't allocate time in future sprints for that, you're going to be working a heck of a lot of overtime because it's just one of those things you forget to do.
Because you can't estimate a bug without researching it a little bit, right? You might have a small little, it might appear to be a small problem, but then you open up the back door and you're like, holy smokers, that's my data access layer and I have to rewrite that thing. Or there's a big bug in it somewhere. So you have to do a little bit of investigation to assess the impact of a bug or how the consequences of fixing it so that you can estimate it. And that's what brings down our total amount of time that we can give to developing new work by assessing some of this rework that has to happen.
So we know that we're going to have to perform this activity. So instead of lying to ourselves and saying we don't have to do it, or instead of forgetting about it, sweeping it under the rug, we're going to allocate a percentage of time and weight our sprints estimate to completion, we said was 13 weeks, 12.93. But we're going to bump that up just a little bit because we know the cone of uncertainty exists and we know we're going to spend some time. So we're going to say, you know, we're going to just throw this off by 5%. Right, we're just going to bump this up by 5%. Right? So I just take the number that I divide, my velocity, and I just, instead of being a 7.75, I'm taking 95% of that 7.75. Right? And I'm getting 13.61 weeks. I'm more comfortable giving the 13.61 to management than I am the 12.93. Knowing that I'm only in the second sprint, and according to the cone of uncertainty, I'm still off, right? But I'm getting better. And I know that the 13.61, or really 14 weeks, or 14 sprints, I keep saying weeks. Okay, moving forward, we're using 1-week sprints.
Perfect.
Yeah, because I can't get the 1 week out of my head. So now let's just do the math going forward. It's really just the same thing. So we've, you know, in the last sprint, we started at 99. We completed 8. Okay. We added 4 OBTWs. We added 2 bugs. Okay. So now our sprint backlog is 97. Okay. We did 8. We asked for 8. We completed 8. That makes our velocity 7.7. Right. So we've added 2 more OBTWs. The good news, I'll get to your question in just 1 second because I'm almost done here. The good news is the OBTWs tend to go down a little bit over time. Not always, but bugs tend to go up. Okay, so we've added 3 bugs. We've also removed 3 items from the backlog. I'm very optimistic that, you know, the business owners have removed the items from the backlog. If we take the product backlog size divided by 7.7, it will give us 12 sprints to completion. However, we should still weight that by 5%, which gives me 12.63 sprints to completion. And we can continue doing this until we get to sprint 5. And my argument is after 5 sprints, your velocity seems to level off. You're going to know if your user stories estimates were consistent, or at least inconsistently consistent. Okay? You're going to know about what the bug rate is, so you can start readjusting this number here, your weighted average. Right? You're going to say, you know, the bugs are getting a little higher, so we should probably, you know, allocate a little bit more time for bugs and rework. Okay? And what will happen is, as you progress down the line, you still will have this number. This is the true number, right? This is velocity divided by the number of items in the backlog. But by weighting that average just a little bit, you can bring that number down. And you know, with the cone of uncertainty, that now by sprint 5, we're at the tighter end of the cone, right? That these are fairly accurate estimates. And before I get to your question, because we're just about done, and which is good because we also only have a few minutes to go. One last thing that we want to bring up, it's very important, is you can use this methodology in any environment. You can use it at, like, Telerik, we're an ISV. I can tell you exactly when Joel's going to release his product. He releases 6 times a year. I can tell you the date. I can't tell you every feature. Right? Using this technique, you can then say, well, you know, if we had all the features on the roadmap, we're not going to make our deadline. And then you can start adding and removing features to the backlog and reducing, saying, okay, well, what if we made this, you know, a 76 or something like that? You know, will we make the release date? If you're in a fixed bid project and you have some flexibility over the deliverable, the same thing can happen. If you are in an environment like you're in a banking situation and you get fined €1 million a day past a compliance date, and you're using the agile estimation techniques, and you realize you have to be done in 10 weeks, but this is telling you 10.9, you know, you're realizing, it's $1 million a day, we're going to be 2 weeks off, you know, with 20, you know, we can have $14 million of fines, or maybe we can add some more resources, right, because we have no flexibility in the resource.
Or cut other features.
Perhaps. Or cut other features that are not required, right? Maybe we don't need the email me my password feature, you know, on day one of this, but we really need the compliance for the banking regulation feature, which is absolutely critical, right? Or if a trade show is coming, right, and marketing needs to build materials for that trade show. And we'll conclude with, you ask, you know, you're going to go back to your offices, right? So just let me bring up the slide, right? You know, just again to kind of, because there's not much more to it. You go back to your offices on Monday after tech ed and you say, we would like to start working with agile estimation. Joel, you get the pushback, I get the pushback. The first piece of pushback you get is, well, your estimates are wrong. You're admitting to me your estimates are wrong. And I then say, walk the boss or the decision maker through the cone of uncertainty. You don't have to get all technical and show them the cone of uncertainty, but walk them through the fundamental concept, right? That, you know, since the beginning of software development, right, our estimates have always gotten better as the project progressed. And because of that, we're going to use that to our advantage and re-estimate at the end of every sprint.
And because we have things like planning poker and a product backlog and, more importantly, re-estimation, what we're promising to the business is that we're committed to always delivering the cream of the pot, right? The highest level valued features. That's what we're committing to, and that we're going to work with them to determine what those are.
Okay, so we are done. However, real quick, we have 1 minute. Someone had a question, but I'm going to take your question at the when we're done, only because this is in the tech ed materials. We handed in the slides on time. Obviously, the slides I made on the fly are not there. I've also put this a full deck of this on SlideShare. So you just Google my name on SlideShare, and it has a more robust deck that has tons of extra slides. We like to talk as opposed to have you stare at slides. And one other thing is, Joel, tell them where we're going to be, and I'll make the slide.
We are going to be at the Telerik booth, just kind of right outside there. There's going to be a thing tonight. We're going to be there for a couple hours. Come and talk to us about Agile and estimation. We can share war stories and even go deeper into some of these techniques that you might glean some happiness from. Free beer, apparently.
I think they give us free beer at the reception.
All I want is Wi-Fi, though. I mean, I could get beer anywhere. I need Wi-Fi.
So he's got the first question, and when everyone rushes up and asks us questions. But that is it. I'll pull up. So we're going to be at the Telerik booth starting about now-ish, you know, after we pack up our stuff. And I think it goes to like 8 o'clock, the reception. And from there, I'll just pull up our Twitter handles and all that other fun stuff. And that'll be it. So thank you all for coming. And hopefully you can go back and take Agile estimation back into your environment. So with that, enjoy. Folks, take that. We should run around and just say, Estimation.
Yeah.
That could go on YouTube. Estimation. Thanks. Enjoy the rest of Tech Ed. I know. You suck.
You look ripped or something. What are you? Holy smokers, you're a machine.
Question.
How you doing?
I was just wondering.